Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We're reading today from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 75, Duryodhana Humiliated. We are reading text 16 through 22. I'm just going to read through until 22, and we'll do that responsively. So there's a lot here, so I'll just do the English. 16. Surrounded by guards, King Yudhishthira's queens came out on their chariots to see the fun, just as the demigods' wives appeared in the sky in celestial airplanes. As maternal cousins and intimate friends sprinkled the queens with liquids, the ladies' faces bloomed with shy smiles, enhancing the queen's splendid beauty. Report. The maternal cousins referred to here are Lord Krishna and such brothers of his as Gada and Sharana, and the friends mentioned are such persons as Bhishma and Arjuna. 17. As the queen squirted water from syringes at their brothers-in-law and other male companions, their own garments became drenched, revealing their arms, breasts, thighs, and waists. In their excitement, the flowers fell from their loosened braids. By these charming pastimes, they agitated those with contaminated consciousness. Report. Srila Prabhupada writes, such behaviors between pure males and females is enjoyable, but persons who are materially contaminated become lustful. And I think we all understand that without further discussion. 18. The emperor, mounted upon his chariots drawn by excellent horses wearing golden collars, appeared splendid in the company of his wives, just like the brilliant Rajasuya sacrifices surrounded by its various rituals. Report. King Yudhishthira with his queens appeared like the personified Rajasuya sacrifice surrounded by its beautiful rituals. 19. The priests led the king through the execution of the final rituals of Patni Samyaja and Avabritya. Then they had him and Queen Draupadi sip water for purification and bathe in the Ganges. The kettle drums of the gods resounded along with those of human beings. Demigods, sages, forefathers, and humans all poured down showers of flowers. All the citizens belonging to the various orders of Varna and Ashrama then bathed in that place where even the most grievous sinner can immediately be freed from all sinful reactions. So text 22, we'll do the Sanskrit. Atarajahate shaume Paradaya svalankrita Ritviksadasya vipradin Anarcha baranambarai Ataraja hate shaume Paradaya svalankrita Ritvik sadasya vipradin Anarcha baranambarai Ata raja hate shaume Paradaya svalankrita Ritvik sadasya vipradin Anarcha baranambarai. Ata raja hate shaume Haridaya svalankrita Vipiksadasya vipradin Ladies? Atta, next, Raja, the king, Ahate, unused, Shalme, a pair of silken garments, Paridaya, putting on, Sualankrita, nicely ornamented, Ritvik, the priest, Sadasya, the officiating members of the assembly, Vipra, the Brahmins, Adin, and others. Anarcha, he worshipped. Abharana, with ornaments. Ambarai, and clothing. Translation purport by the disciples of this divine grace, Srila Prabhupada. Next, the king put on new silken garments and adorned himself with fine jewelry. He then honored the priests, assembly officials, learned Brahmins, and other guests by presenting them with ornaments and clothing. Report. Srila Prabhupada writes, the king not only dressed himself and decorated himself, but he also gave clothing and ornaments to all the priests and to the others who had participated in the yajnas. In this way, he worshipped them all. Om Gyanate Vrandasya Gyananjana Salakaya Chakshu Mithanina Tasma Shri Gravina Vanchakalpa Tudrasya Kriva Sindhu Devacha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. So this is a further description of the Rajasuya sacrifice and all of the activities that went on and all of the festivities and wonderful celebrations in a very, very grand and gorgeous way. King Yudhishthira is honored and worshipped by all of the citizens. There's very elaborate worship and reverence given to Maharaj Yudhishthira. But in this verse, it's also interesting to point out that he in turn also served all the members of the kingdom. He first served the Brahmins and then all the other citizens. So not only was he given all of these fine ornaments and clothing, but he distributed clothing, ornaments, and gave so much worship and honor to all of the other members of the community of his kingdom, and of course particularly the priests and the Brahmins. So this was the system of monarchy. The system of monarchy that was there in the time of Maharaj Yudhishthira and lasted a little while, a couple more generations, and then we see the decline as Kali Yuga progressed. Actually, after Maharaj Parikshit and his departure, there was maybe one or two, Janmajaya, his son, maybe one or two, you know, righteous kings in the Vedic style. But then, you know, deterioration began because Kali Yuga had ensued by that point. So this system was actually a perfect system, which was ordained by Krishna. In Srimad Bhagavatam 2:27-22, Srila Prabhupada writes, his purport, the Kshatriyas, or the ruling administrators of any part of the universe, either on this planet or another planet, are factually the representatives of the Almighty Personality of Godhead, and they are meant to lead the subjects towards the path of God realization. Every state and its administrators, regardless of the nature of the administration, monarchy or democracy, oligarchy, dictatorship, or autocracy, have the prime responsibility to lead the citizens towards God realization. This is essential for all human beings and is a duty of the Father, spiritual master, and ultimately of the state to take the responsibility of leading the citizens towards this end. So it's interesting that Srila Prabhupada is pointing out that it's not necessarily monarchy just in itself that's particularly of value or is being praised. It is a system of any government which leads its citizens towards progressive self-realization and understanding their duties under the laws of God. It was also a perfect system, according to the Varnashram or Vedic conception, was a system of mutual service, not exploitation. So this is what we've seen in recent years, recent centuries, we could say, as Kali Yuga has progressed, we've seen deterioration of the ruling class to the point that monarchies or almost any form of government has become very, very corrupt and is not actually working for the benefit of the people. Srimad Bhagavatam 4.12.10, Srila Prabhupada says, a king is not meant to simply realize taxes from the citizens and accumulate wealth to spend in sense gratification. World monarchy has failed ever since kings began to satisfy their personal senses with the taxes accumulated from the citizens. Of course, whether the system is monarchy or democracy, the same corruption is still going on. So this is the point. Whether it's monarchy or democracy is not really that critical. The point is that there is corruption in the ruling class, and the ruling class of people are not acting in the interests of the people. But because monarchy, which was prevalent throughout the world, actually was prevalent throughout Asia, throughout Europe, and practically every area of the world up until the last couple hundred years, some type of monarchy was the prevailing system. You saw that everywhere in the Western and the Eastern cultures. The problem is, as it became corrupt, people gained less and less faith in their kings, their rulers, or emperors, or whoever it might be. And because of that corruption, and because they were not actually meeting the needs of the people, therefore alternative ideas arose. And so the idea of democracy at some point became more and more popular, particularly probably from about the mid-1700s. Some of the different philosophical movements at that time, the so-called Age of Enlightenment. I'm not quite sure what the Enlightenment was, but they call it the Age of Enlightenment, where people were turning more from, this is when I need T.T.B. Mooney. You know. Anyway, he'll write to me and correct me on what mistakes I make here in presentation of this. But at least I'm counting on that. He keeps me honest. Anyway, I think during the Age of Enlightenment, which was the mid-1700s, we saw more and more of these democratic ideals. And of course, that culminated, we know, in the Revolutionary War in America, and then in the French Revolution, which was a few years after that. And so there were all these, Rousseau and so many of these people talked about the rights of man, and there was so much political and philosophical clamor for change. And it was justified because the ruling classes were not acting in the interest of the people. You know, we saw how they... when you think of the American Revolution, the king at the time, King George III from England, he wasn't actually doing too badly right then, but within a few years, he had many, many bouts of total insanity throughout his life. In the last 10 years of his life, King George was, you know, completely, he was institutionalized. They had to keep him locked up practically. And these are the people who are, you know, running countries and colonies and, you know, so many people. So naturally, he probably wasn't making real good decisions, you know, in that mental state of mind. You know, but not just to pick on King George, we can see this, you know, everywhere. You know, so eventually, because of this corruption, people were overthrown and the ideas of democracy came about, because basically people would rather elect their own corrupt rulers than accept a corrupt ruler that's imposed upon them. You know, and this is what we see, that, I mean, even in America, which probably has the best continuous track record for over 200 years of a democratically elected government, we actually haven't done too badly. Even still, isn't there every year, there's always some scandal. Somebody is, ending up in trouble for exploiting their position. I used to live in Illinois, and Illinois is a very remarkable state. I think in the last... six governors of Illinois, at least four of them have ended up in prison. I mean, seriously, I'm not making this up or exaggerating it. The latest one, Blagojevich, I think he just got out. We had Kerner. There were so many I can name. And it was always something to do with irregularities in their finances. You know, meaning they took bribes or whatever. So this is going on, and of course it goes on all over the world. We know in many countries, especially countries that are less prosperous, it's practically a way of life. Not to name any names or any countries that we might think of where, you know, this is going on. And the idea is because there are no good rulers who are really acting in the interest of the people, this corruption comes about. And part of the reason there are no good rulers is because there are no Brahmins. Of course, you know, the king, the monarch, whatever, was supposed to take advice from the Brahmins, from religious spiritual leaders who understood the purpose of life and understood what the purpose of their rule was. And so without that good advice, without spiritual information and spiritual understanding, naturally people are going to tend to sink to their more base nature and material corruption ensues. So this idea of the concept of service to man, what to speak of service to God, has been largely lost in politics. So we don't see rulers like Maharaj Yudhisthira, who saw themselves as servants of the people. The actual Vedic political system, we often think of as being a monarchy where it was handed down, you know, from father to son or whatever. But the Varnashram system is not really based upon birthright. It's a meritocracy. It's based upon qualification. Krishna clearly says in Bhagavad Gita, the Varnashram system is based upon guna and karma, one's nature, one's qualities, and one's work, one's ability. If you show the nature and the work and the ability to do a particular position, then you're qualified, not simply that you're born into it. And of course, this is what has happened to the Brahminical culture in India to a large degree. It became a hereditary caste designation rather than something based upon actual quality and actual character of the people. So we see this degradation coming down more and more. And in fact, in past times, when there was more of a Vedic system, if a king was not qualified, they'd be removed. We know the story of King Dana, a very evil, corrupt king who was simply, you know, hurting the people. So what happened? At that time, the Brahmins had power. The Brahmins cursed him and killed him. They took him out, you know, because he was not qualified and he was causing so much trouble and disruption. You know, when the earth became overburdened by the demoniac kings such as Kamsa, what happened? Bhumi goes to Brahma, they approach Lord Vishnu. Krishna himself at that time descends, and one of the reasons he descended is to relieve the burden of the world from the demoniac rulers. Of course, he also came to establish religious principles and to give shelter to his devotees. But one of the three reasons that Krishna comes, according to Bhagavad Gita, is, you know, Vinashaya Chadushkatam, to take care of, to get rid of those demoniac elements who are causing disruption. You know, and it comes from the top. You can't really blame the people as much as you can the leaders. Just like Prabhupada said, 90 or 95% of people are innocent. He said, but they're misled by demoniac leaders. So in other words, the average person isn't necessarily demoniac. They don't necessarily have horrible intentions, but they're misled as far as the real meaning and goals of life by those leaders who do not have good intention. And of course, in Kali Yuga, everyone is Sudra. Nobody has the qualification of Brahman. No one has the qualification of Kshatriyas. And therefore, we see incompetent and corrupt leaders. But those in the position of authority actually have the duty to take care of their charges, both material and spiritual needs. So someone who is seeming to do this becomes very popular. If somebody is saying, I'm going to help people, I'm actually going to do something, I'm going to change the system. Don't we hear this over and over and over, one politician after another? I'm not part of the system, I'm going to change it all. Then they become part of the system and the same thing happens. But, I mean, this is one thing. There's great, this the Prime Minister of India, Modi, now is very, very popular, isn't he? Because people are, at least he talks a good show, you know. I mean, we'll see how, you know, what actually happens. But so far, he is at least saying those things of expressing interest in helping the people and restoring some religious principles. So, you know, I don't even want to comment. I haven't really followed him that well and whether he's really doing a good job or not a good job. But I'm just saying that for many people, that's hopeful that a leader at least expresses the desire to do the things the leader is supposed to do. You know, we're talking about cleaning up the Ganges and the Yamuna, and, you know, doing things which actually have spiritual benefit for the people. Of course, in the past, we had so many great leaders. We have so many wonderful examples of the Srimad Bhagavatam. The Srimad Bhagavatam has stories of dozens and dozens of great leaders. Of course, Lord Ramachandra being our perfect example. We even have the expression Ram Raj. You know, this is like the rule. The rule of Lord Ram is the exemplar of how to perfectly care for the citizens like a father. It's described that in his kingdom, there was no bodily or mental suffering, no disease, old age, bereavement, lamentation, distress, fear, and fatigue. Those were completely absent. Now, what person or politician could run on that platform? I'm going to completely relieve all your fatigue, distress, bereavement. I'll end disease and old age. I think you'd get laughed off the podium, right? But this is what King Ramachandra actually did for his citizens. We also have a wonderful example of King Prithu. You know, of course, Prithu succeeded Vena. You know, he was who was brought in to replace the evil Vena. It says in 4.16.7 Bhagavatam, this King Prithu will be very, very kind to all the citizens. Even though a poor person may trample over the king's head by violating the rules and regulations, the king, out of his causeless mercy, will be forgetful and forgiving. As protector of the world, he'll be as tolerant as the earth itself. So now we mostly see that if anyone does anything, people want to retaliate, right? Somebody threatens my authority or something, then the ruler will want to get back at that person, somehow remove them as an obstacle. King Prithu said, you can trample on my head, and I'll still try to protect you. Prabhupada said in the purport, King Prithu is here and compared to the earthly planet is as far as his tolerance is concerned. Although the earth is always trampled upon by men and animals, it still gives food by producing grains, fruit, and vegetables. As an ideal king, Maharaj Prithu is compared to the earthly planet, and although the citizens might violate the rules and regulations, he would still be tolerant. In other words, it's the duty of the king to look after the comforts of the citizen, even at the cost of his own personal convenience. So this is key. The leader must have a mood of self-sacrifice. If one is simply looking to enhance oneself, to exploit others, to gain something from it, then he's the wrong person for the job. One has to be in that mood of being able to give of oneself, you know, for others. That's actually what leadership means. This is further explained by Prabhupada in the purport of 512.8 in the story of Rahugana and Judd Bharat. Judd Bharat, of course, gave wonderful lectures and examples to Maharaj Rahugana about what the real purpose of being a ruler or a king was. It says, actually, the supreme proprietor of everything is Lord Vishnu. He is the maintainer of everyone. The king, the father, and the guardian are simply representatives of Lord Vishnu, empowered by him to look after the management and maintain things. It is therefore the duty of the head of state to maintain the general populace in such a way that people will ultimately know the goal of life. So not only did the leader need to make sure that all of the material needs and comforts were taken care of the people, the things were organized in a good way, that everything was managed properly, that there was not poverty, that there was not war, that there was not all of these things we see today. But even more important than that, the duty of the leader was to lead the dependents towards devotional service and ultimately to help them become liberated from birth and death. I was just thinking, you could imagine, like, we had an election, and we have this election coming up, and we have these, like, 14 Republicans and all these Democrats, and they're all yelling at each other, right? And I think, what if one was saying, no, I'm the one who's in the best position to liberate you from birth and death. No, actually, I can assure liberation from birth and death because I will establish all of these religious principles. We don't see that going on so much, But that would be very interesting, that if you actually had in a democracy, if you had, Krishna conscious, candidates, what kind of a discussion or debate might go on? It'd be very interesting, wouldn't it? Quite different than what we see today. So this position of helping one's dependents towards, a good material life, leading a religious life, acting in harmony with God's plan, and even more importantly, to understand the purpose of life and to become free from the cycle of birth and death, and to take the process of devotional service. This is the duty not just of the king, but of anyone in a position of authority. For First letter to Shabdev says, one who cannot deliver his dependents from the path of repeated birth and death should never become a spiritual master, a father, a husband, a mother, or worshipable demigod. Well, not too many of us are worshipable demigods, but many of us are fathers, mothers, husbands, wives, etc. So we all have this great responsibility that is given to us, that we need to take up spiritual leadership in whatever sphere of activity, whatever realm of responsibility that Krishna gives to us, and to make sure that we are acting in such a way that those around us or those under us will become Krishna conscious. That is really the purpose, and that is our goal. So I was thinking about what makes effective leaders. What are some of the qualities and characters that will help a leader to have the right attitude and the mood to fulfill these purposes? I'm saying that, first of all, we have the idea of the spiritual character of the leader. This is one of our primary principles. One must set personal example. There's prachar and achar. One, must, of course, has to speak the right principles, but one also has to live them. One has to act in such a way that one inspires others by their own example. Even in parenting, we know this, that often it's our own examples as a parent that are going to speak louder than whatever we instruct the child to do, right? You know, because especially they get to a certain age, and if they see some discrepancy or some hypocrisy, they'll point it out to us real fast, don't they? Children are great at that. Well, you don't do that. You know, what about you? So they'll see that. I mean, that's, of course, you know, a simple example, but it's the same with any position or leadership, that we have to, not that we're necessarily going to be perfect, but we do have to set the right example. And particularly spiritual leadership, meaning setting personal example. And secondly, we have to be able to transmit those ideas, and we have to bring out the spiritual character in others. That's one of the primary responsibilities of anyone who's in leadership, is to help those develop, to help them advance in Krishna consciousness and develop the character and the qualities which are going to help them in their spiritual life. It's not enough to just sort of drill philosophy into somebody or just preach at somebody, but we actually have to somehow inspire them, inspire people to want to take up Krishna consciousness, to want to be a better devotee. That's leadership. You know, it doesn't matter if you're talking to one person on the street or your family or whoever it might be, or to your disciples. You need to inspire these people to take up Krishna consciousness. And of course, we need to also care for all the needs of those who are under our charge. There's a little small movement, you know, there's out there, there's all these different ideas, and you know, you can read 100 books on leadership, and there's so many different plans and ideas and formulas on the best ways to do it, and sometimes we can learn from those things. But I thought one that was interesting, there's a person named Robert Greenleaf, who's developed this idea of servant leadership. I don't know if any of you have heard of him or not, or of that, but it's kind of an interesting concept of servant leadership, because it's very much in line with the kind of leadership we see in Maharaj Yudhisthira and Maharaj Paritu and these great kings. They were actually the original servant leaders, and Greenleaf figured it out about 20 years ago. So, but this is actually the Vedic system. The Vedic system is servant leadership. So some of the ideas of the characteristics of a servant leader, this is from Greenleaf. There's like 6 points, but I sort of changed, you know, to devotee context. So I sort of Krishnaized these a little bit. One was that one must devote themselves to serving the needs of one's spiritual community. 2 is one focused on meeting the needs of those that one leads. 3, to develop devotees to bring out their best spiritual qualities in service. 4 is to coach, guide, and mentor others, encourage their self-expression in their service, to facilitate personal and spiritual growth in all who serve with them, and to listen and build a sense of community amongst the devotees. So these seem like, you know, they're fairly obvious. They're not earth-shaking ideas, but I think it's worth thinking about how we all work together, how we help one another, how we inspire one another to all grow together in Krishna consciousness, not only individually, but as a community. And anyone who has some responsibility has that responsibility to help others to grow in these ways. So I think there's two ways that we need to take up this responsibility. It's like there's two types of dependents. When we talk about those dependents or those who we have some influence on. Don't think of it so much as a question of control, people I'm over or people I control. Think of it as people that you have influence on. Where is your sphere of influence? Obviously there are those who we have immediate authority of, our children, our devotees under care, we have a position of spiritual leadership, and we have, you know, people serve, you know, with us like that. So those are fairly obvious. But we also have a natural authority as representatives of Krishna. In other words, we have been authorized as disciples and grand disciples of Srila Prabhupada to act on his behalf, to act on behalf of the whole spiritual sampradaya, to act on behalf of Krishna and the previous acharyas. In other words, all the instructions of Krishna, the acharyas, of Srila Prabhupada are not meant to like stop at a certain point. It's meant to continue. It's meant to the followers to continue those same instructions, you know, the same philosophy to be given widely to others. So I think that what I'm saying is we need to think about that in a way of we have direct responsibility as natural leaders to all of humanity, actually. And Prabhupada said that. Prabhupada talked about so often that we first had to establish Brahmins, right? He had to establish a group of devotees. He had to train devotees who understood the philosophy so they could go out and be the leaders. The Brahmins are the spiritual leaders of society. So Prabhupada wanted to create Brahmins to become those spiritual leaders who could act on behalf of himself and Krishna and his spiritual master to bring people to Krishna consciousness. So that's a very important position of leadership, and every single devotee has that. Every single devotee has spiritual knowledge, and having spiritual knowledge is powerful, and it's important, and it needs to be used. It needs to be used properly. And people do accept us as authorities. When we go out and we talk to people, we preach to people, you know, they may not accept us as total authorities, but they often accept us at least as authorities over Vedic knowledge or spiritual process, or whatever that might be. I think I mentioned before, Keshava mentioned a couple days ago that we went out to a Polk State college in Lakeland. We did a preaching program. I've gone about three times to that school. And, you know, the students are very interested, and they ask a lot of questions, and they do, to some degree, accept us as authority. I remember the time before I came, they were all asking, this time they had a variety of questions. Last time I went, all they want to know about is reincarnation. Well, what happens when? But they kept asking the questions, but the interesting thing is, not whether they were good questions or not, but they were accepting me, you know, as representative of Srila Prabhupada and the Vedas, as an authority. Like, we know about reincarnation, how it works. And whatever those questions might be, the students often see us in that way, that we do have some knowledge that we can impart. You know, so that gives us a great responsibility to try to, you know, to try to give spiritual knowledge to suffering, conditioned souls. It was kind of interesting that one young man who is very talkative came up afterwards, and he was talking very animated and wanted to talk all. And turns out that he had been to my program, my lecture, like a year ago, and he'd gotten a Bhagavad Gita from me, and he had started chanting Hare Krishna, and he was reading Bhagavad Gita, and he was very interested and, you know, sounding, I mean, I don't think he was ready, but he was kind of like he wanted to become a devotee. You know, he was becoming a devotee. So we never know what effect that we have on people, you know, because we are the representatives of Srila Prabhupada. When we go out, as long as we are following Srila Prabhupada's instructions and we are repeating his words, to the degree that we are faithful to our guru, to that degree we are proper representatives of him. And to that degree, Srila Prabhupada occasionally will give us a little bit of empowerment to be successful. And of course, what, you know, why we are successful, nothing that I said in 30 minutes to this young man, but because he read Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. Because he had contact with the words of the pure devotee and the Bhagavad Gita, you know, he was becoming convinced. So when we have those opportunities, you know, we need to take them very seriously and try to and trying to see ourselves in that leadership role for humanity at large, what to speak of our leadership role amongst the devotees. And we're going to end with, I probably read this at least twice a year, but, you know, it's so good. Srila Prabhupada exemplified the perfect mood of the servant leader. In his address in Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's Vyas Puja in 1973, it said, Srila Prabhupada in the same ecstatic mood spoke, anyway, it is by his grace, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj, his guru, it is by his grace I was forced to give up my family life, and he brought me some way or other in preaching his gospel. So this is a memorable day. What he desired, I am trying a little bit, and you are all helping me, so I have to thank you more. You are actually representatives of my Guru Maharaj, because you are helping me in executing the order of my Guru Maharaj. Thank you very much. So this is incredible humility of Srila Prabhupada. You know, that somehow or another he gives credit to us, you know, as insignificant as we are, the tiny little service that his disciples are able to do. He saw as representative as his Guru Maharaj, and he sees himself as the servant of his disciples. Why? What's his service? His service is to give a spiritual instruction. That's what Srila Prabhupada is thinking. He's not thinking, oh, I have all these disciples, they'll do whatever I want, I have people to wait on. He's thinking, I have an incredibly important service, a divine service given to me by Krishna and by my guru to help these young boys and girls to become Krishna conscious. Therefore, I am serving them by giving them Krishna consciousness. And of course, our attitude is very different. Our attitude is Srila Prabhupada is saving us from birth and death. Srila Prabhupada has given us, you know, this absolute truth, this perfect Vedic knowledge. And he is actually inspiring us to take this up and empowering us to take the same Krishna consciousness and give it to others. So, in that mood, we all take up seriously the activity of spiritual leadership. We will advance more and more, and this movement will grow. So thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Any discussion? Oh, lots of hands. Let's start with Jivanath in the back, and then I saw Janmashtami and Trivikram. Or catch Trivikram when you're back in that area.
You were mentioning how the society is seeing us as sort of leaders or authorities. I heard a nice story from Chaturatma the other day, how he was called in for jury duty. So he showed up in full Vaishnav gear with tilak in the works, thinking...
Was he trying to get out?
He's trying to get out of jury duty, and he was chosen in the first couple of people because they accept us now as honest, forthright, good people. Whereas before we probably were the freaks, now we're actually the good people.
Now they took him.
So they took him in the first couple of choices, yeah. He was a little dismayed about it.
What's interesting, as long as we're glorifying Chaturatma, I remember another story about that he works at Lowe's, of course, and I guess he was doing really well with his performance and his sales and everything in his department. And some big, you know, district manager came, and the manager was telling him about him. He said, oh, yeah, and that's it, Charles or whatever. He said, and he's actually a Hare Krishna devotee. And the manager said, well, you should hire more of those devotees. They do so well. So, yeah. Okay. Good recognition. Good PR. Chirukha.
Sometimes we hear Srila Prabhupada write or say that the people get a leader that they deserve.
They get the leader that they deserve?
Yeah, yeah.
You okay. Know,
can you say something on that? I mean,
well, you know, there's also the expression cheaters and cheated, right? I mean, if people want a cheating leader, they're going to get one. If one wants a cheating guru, one will get a cheating cheater. You know, so yeah, people, according to the desire, they'll be led in a certain way. But I think we can also see the other side of it is that, you know, the population large is also misled. You know, they're misled from birth. They're misled by leaders in the very beginning. So by the time they have the opportunity to make choices, they make bad choices. You know, yeah, and they want some. I read that, you know, this Donald Trump, who I thought was a complete clown, you know, I thought he was a joke. He's actually leading in the polls. You know, this is, you know, there's an example why that people actually want somebody like that. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? You know, I mean, if you don't learn throughout your life how to be discerning, how to make good choices, what is important, what to prioritize, people don't know. Somebody, you know, talks big, you know, they laugh at him, they think he's funny, so yeah, let's vote for him. You know, or he appeals to their baser nature, is actually what's happening. He really does. He's appealing to people's, you know, ethnic prejudices and stereotypes, and really to very low mode of ignorance nature. Okay. I think I can get away with bashing Donald Trump. I usually don't want to do that, but I think we don't have any supporters, do we? Okay. 10 miles to me.
There's a nice passage of Prophet Pravindus Roop tells us, I think it was in 72, he arrived in New York Airport, and there were news reporters there. And a news reporter asked the Prophet, why have you come to this country? And Prabhupada responded, I've come to give you a head. Your country has no head. And then he went on to explain ecumenical culture. That was like a real mind grabber.
His
initial response.
Yeah, that's a real nice point. And as I said, Prabhupada made that point many times. And he told us, yes, a society without a head, without a brahminical, you know, class, there's no head. There's no intelligence to society. Yeah, nice point. Anything over on the left side of the room before right side of the room? Okay. Yeah, Prabhu? Okay, Prana, then up here.
In the first canto, on Parikshit Maharaja's appearance, Srila Prabhupada made a very significant one sentence that affected me a lot. That he said that King Parikshit, Kripa Acharya, they were making the chart forecasting his future. So Prabhupada gave a purport on this.
Is it his astrology chart?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. King Parikshit, what he's going to do in the future. Mm-hmm. Srimad Bhagavatam will manifest, Brahmana cars. So one purport Prabhupada write that because he was a great leader, because his grandfather, King Yudhishthira, and himself, all the great leaders, they draw their happiness from the spiritual source. They never depend on the enjoyment or their existence of happiness from the body, or that's why they never exploit. So long one is fixed in devotional service or representing God, then their happiness is making them indifferent. As a result, they can treat equally and be really compassionate and help others. Otherwise, not possible.
That's a great point. So in other words, what you're saying is, as long as one has material desires, there's going to be the tendency to exploit, because one is going to try to fulfill those desires at the expense of others. So only one who is really pure, who is not acting on that platform, is only acting on the spiritual platform, can really just work to serve others and not themselves.
Yeah,
nice point, thank you.
Another one I was just thinking, I just read Srila Prabhupada says in 76 that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur event, his appearance day just passed couple of days ago. He says Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur even desired to have a preacher as his son. So he prayed. So his son, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur, he was a lion guru. He was preaching so vigorously, and now he's preaching through his bona fide disciple and his followers.
Jai.
He's talking about himself. That's very nice.
Jai. I'll go to Srila Bhaktivinoda and Bhaktisiddhanta, Srila Prabhupada. And we come from a very, very wonderful heritage, wonderful line of spiritual masters. It's true.
So thanks for that lecture. I was just wondering, how would you reconcile qualities of living in Western democracy with this idea of spiritual leadership?
Mm-hmm.
Like how would you mentioned Hare Krishna candidates, right? So how would that play out in reality?
Well, that's an interesting question. And of course, there have been some attempts. Some devotees have tried to start political things, run for candidates for different places. I don't think anyone's ever won. Although, you know, Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii, who is a Hare Krishna devotee, and she, you know, she gives recognition to Srila Prabhupada and, you know, et cetera. So It's interesting because when you're saying how would that actually look, I thought that she would probably have to speak really carefully and not really say very much, but she actually speaks very straightforwardly. You know, she talks about Bhagavad Gita and Krishna and, you know, praises Bhagavad Gita, and she's publicly gives recognition to Srila Prabhupada. So apparently you can get away with it. You can do it. You know, if people are not that against what we're doing. But the first part of what you said is that reconciling and like sort of in a modern democratic society, particularly like some of these ideas, I don't know if you're, that's what you're referring to, of monarchy and the way that our traditions might be from the Srimad Bhagavatam.
This discussion around theocracy, right?
Yeah.
In India, good case, right? So
yeah.
If you have a Hindu,
Yeah.
So how do you balance that?
Yeah. You know, in some of the purports I read in the beginning, it was interesting that Prabhupada was clearly stating that it's not just a question of monarchy versus democracy. It's a question of supporting God consciousness. In other words, that you know, it doesn't matter whether one is whether it's a kingdom or whether one is a democracy. If one is exploiting the people, or if one is has only atheistic goals, or if one is supporting God consciousness and bringing the people to that, then it's a value. It doesn't really matter what the form of government is. I remember another thing that Prabhupada talked about once, it was the idea of, you know, like what type of government, and could we impose Krishna consciousness, which is kind of related to what you're saying. Could if we were, like, say, in charge, could we impose Krishna consciousness? And at one point, Prabhupada said, it's not a question of imposing a religion. He said, but we should... any government should support the religious principles. So the four principles of, you know, of mercy, cleanliness, austerity, and truthfulness. See, truthfulness, that's the last one standing in Kali Yuga. So in other words, he was saying that any government or any religion can support the basic principles of religion. So even if you were a Muslim government and you supported, you know, the basic principle of religion, it wouldn't be so bad. I mean, we'd prefer, of course, that people were taught Krishna consciousness. But so I think that's one way we reconcile it, is by emphasizing those basic principles of religion. And those are things that, I mean, who can't get behind truthfulness, cleanliness? You know, I mean, they're very basic. And as we, and then, of course, Prabhupada also talked about using the resources of the government sometimes to help support the Sankirtan movement. So in other words, as we simply have broad support for the chanting of Hare Krishna, prasadam distribution, you can imagine if we have, you know, like, oh, I know, who was I with? Was that you, Keshu? We were talking about that ramp on the highway? I can't remember if that was, I can't remember. We were talking about, they built this ramp, you know, off of the exit here. You know, and I think they spent $2 million on it. So I don't know how important it was that they build a new ramp there for $2 million. Think what we could do with $2 million. Think what we could do with, you know, the budget of the U.S. government, which is in the trillions. In other words, if we had the kind of governmental, you know, just the resources to be able to promote Sankirtan, festivals, prasadam distribution, well, think what an incredible impact it would be. So there's many ways that, you know, through having some more government control position, whatever it might be, without necessarily imposing you have to be a devotee or you go to jail or something, you know, we can have tremendous impact on changing the world. It's a long discussion. I'm sure there's more that we could say about it. Okay. One more, Madame Mahan. You get the last word again.
I was just remembering where Prabhupada had mentioned about one religion or another religion, like non-sectarian or I forgot what the political term is, but he says it's not that there's no religion, he says, but whatever religion you have, you're supposed to follow.
Mm-hmm.
So you would support all the religions. In other words, if you say you're a Christian, then you have to go to church, you have to do your religious duties, whichever religion it was. So in that way, that's one answer I remember from the point.
Yeah, and you know, and Prabhupada gave indications like this in several different discussions, and different, like, you know, discussions, morning walks or room conversations like this when we discuss these points, that obviously there would be some transitional stage, especially in a democratic society, of how you would bring about Krishna consciousness. And, you know, through the whole support of the Varnashram system, which is meant, you know, to support a religious foundation. I mean, Varnashram isn't necessarily even necessarily Vaishnavism. Of course, we have Daivi Varnashram, the idea which would be, you know, but just in itself doesn't necessarily mean that everybody would be like a Vaishnava devotee of the Lord, but that everybody would be working cooperatively according to religious principles, you know, to support, you know, the general aims, you know, of a God-conscious society. So, I mean, I think there's many ways that we can see just practically. You know, I'd love to be given the opportunity, if we could sit down and try to figure it out, if we had that opportunity, how are we going to make the world Krishna conscious if we had a little more political position? Okay, we see you in class. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.